From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I talk with writer John Nichols. His novel, The Milagro Beanfield War, has just been made into a movie by Robert Redford. His new novel, American Blood, follows a group of soldiers through the violence of Vietnam and their violent return home. Also today, I'll speak with Cynthia Payne. For years, Payne ran a brothel in London. Her life as a madam is the basis of the new film, Personal Services. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new compact disc recording of Verdi's Don Carlo. And our language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg, says if you've never really understood the Pledge of Allegiance, you're not alone. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is writer John Nichols. He lives in Taos, New Mexico, the setting of his trilogy that explores the conflicts between the Native Americans, the Chicanos, the hippies, and the land developers in that region. It was through his work as an investigative reporter that Nichols became active in the land and water rights conflicts that dominated northern New Mexico politics. He sided with the Native American and Chicano farmers who were being pressured by developers to relinquish their water rights. That clash was the subject of the Milagro Beanfield War, the first installment of his trilogy. It's just been made into a movie by Robert Redford, starring Ruben Blades and Sonia Braga. It's scheduled to open in the fall. Nichols wrote the screenplay. That's his third venture in films. His first published book, The Sterile Cuckoo, was made into a movie starring Liza Minnelli. Nichols also did the final rewrite on the screenplay for Missing. John Nichols' new novel is American Blood. It starts off in Vietnam, where a small group of American soldiers commits a string of atrocities and sexual mutilations. The book follows two soldiers after they return home. One soldier continues to play out his Vietnam behavior. The main character is attracted to and repulsed by violence and doubts his control over his impulses. The book has graphic scenes of violence and sex. American Blood has just been published by Henry Holt. John Nichols, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks a lot.
Every conceivable atrocity is committed in the first few pages of your new novel. And I'm wondering if any Vietnam veterans are getting angry with you about the book, because in a way that's just the image that veterans have been trying to change.
Yeah, I don't. The book has been out for about a month now, so I haven't gotten a whole lot of reaction. I'm not really tuned in, I guess, to a real wide range of reactions. People that I've talked to who were involved in the Vietnam War, most of them have had a fairly sympathetic reaction to the book. Nobody has said that this is really, you know, a bunch of lies or that it wasn't that way at all. Some people have said, well, do you mean this more metaphorically in that you've telescoped an awful lot of atrocity into the experience of a single soldier? But otherwise, people seem to feel that it's fairly accurate, either realistically or metaphorically, about the whole mood and history of the war.
Well, the book seems to be about, in a way, how immersion into violence through participating in a war keeps mm-hmm. you in a violent state of mind, and it's about bringing the violence home from the war.
Whole theory about the book, basically, is it's too bad that the book has been interpreted so much as a Vietnam novel, because the way I see it, Vietnam is simply a metaphor for 450 years of American history, and what I perceive as the violence of Vietnam is not something that originated in the war in Vietnam, but that is obviously a real integral part of our culture, and that's where it's birthed. The problem with the narrator in the book, who goes through all these atrocities in Vietnam and then returns to the United States, is that he cannot leave the war simply because the foundations of the war are in American culture, not Southeast Asia.
In a way, I was thinking that the book might have an interesting personal meaning for you, and I was wondering if, I know that you're not a veteran yourself, but I was wondering if you feared that had you gone to war, that you would be unable to shake the violence that you were exposed to there.
No.
And here's why I ask you that. I've been reading some of your memoirs, and you were exposed to guns and stuff like that when you were young. And in describing your childhood, you wrote that you and your cousins grew up by a pond. We grew bloodthirsty together. And you just describe, you know, shooting at barn swallows. And
oh, yeah, I was brought up handling guns. I was brought up hunting. And when I was much younger, though I was raised to take, you know, real good care of guns and stuff like that, to be aware of safety, I was brought up duck hunting, upland game hunting, things like that. There was a certain part of my childhood where myself and my cousins, yeah, we just marauded through the woods when we realized nobody was looking and shot everything that moved simply as sport to practice. That's pretty common in this country. I never really liked the film The Deer Hunter because I felt politically it was real off base. But one of the scenes in The Deer Hunter that I thought was real accurate of just a strain of American culture is when these guys go off hunting, you know, and they're driving around in a Jeep being real careless with guns. They're drinking beer. That whole careless attitude about violence and killing things is real prevalent in our culture.
You also wrote that in the late 60s, when you were leaving New York to move to New Mexico, you wrote that you were afraid if you stayed in New York, you would have either committed suicide or hit the streets with an indiscriminately blazing rifle.
Yeah,
I keep getting this feeling that you have all these violent impulses yourself that you're trying to come to terms with.
I don't think it's quite that personal. I think I grew up in a very violent culture. I was, for example, I was very athletic. I played 3 varsity sports a year all through high school and all through college. I played football. I played hockey. I also ran track. In football and hockey, I was trained into a whole lot of aggressiveness. You know, in schooling, I was trained into a whole lot of aggressiveness. The fact of the matter is we live in a society which teaches people to be extraordinarily violent. It may not be that you are taught to actually put on a pair of brass knuckles and you know, bash your way to the top of the corporate ladder that way. But in a sense, people tear each other apart in an almost feral manner in order to get to the top or to win or whatever, you know, in our society. So certainly this country, for example, in Vietnam, it took us, I think, 13 years to kill 58,000 American soldiers. In our nation, I think the statistics are something like 50,000 people a year are murdered in our country, you know, yearly. We don't raise as big a stink. We kill 50,000 or 40,000 people a year in car accidents, and we maim and mutilate sort of 250,000 more. We accept an extraordinary amount of carnage in the United States. A couple of years ago, even in the Reagan administration, issued a report on violence, which said the United States was by far the most violent nation in the world in terms of murder, rape, armed robbery, battery, assault, things like that. We were 10 times more violent than Japan, 6 times more than West Germany.
One of the paradoxes of writing a novel about violence is that in writing about it, you add to the violence that exists. You have some very explicit violent scenes and sexual mutilation scenes.
Well, you know, if you're a cultural worker trying to make certain kinds of statements, sometimes, would you say, for example, that Picasso's Guernica adds to violence or it's a statement against violence? You know, here is a painting that has been accepted almost as a symbol of anti-war, anti-fascist art, all right? It's about, you know, the painting has extraordinary violence in it. Goya did a whole series of etchings, lithographs of extraordinary violence and mutilation and brutality and rape and cruelty in his whole series on the horrors of war, which depict the Napoleonic invasion of Spain. Somebody like Dalton Trumbo writing Johnny Got His Gun. This book is almost unreadable because a person is so mutilated, and yet it's a very strong anti-war statement. I don't know if you've ever seen a film like Peter Watkins' The War Game, which is an attempt to recreate the effects of a nuclear holocaust in Britain. The film is terrible to watch. It's very violent. You know, you've got firestorms. You've got people being blown through plate glass windows. You've got splinters of straw going through people's skulls or whatever, you know. But is the point of that to add to the violence? You know, basically you come out of it with a total aversion to violence or the possibility of nuclear war, and it becomes a very strong anti-war, anti-violence statement, unlike something like Rambo or you know, the Dukes of Hazzard or whatever.
John Nichols is my guest. His new novel is called American Blood. Our listeners might be familiar with your New Mexico trilogy that includes the Milagro Beanfield War that's just been made into a movie, and The Magic Journey, and Nirvana Blues. Now, you moved to New Mexico from New York in 1969. Mm-hmm. It's funny, it was a place that was attracting a lot of people in 1969. It had become a kind of mecca for the counterculture.
When I decided to leave New York City and go to New Mexico, my reasons were basically political. I wanted to go to a place that, for me, was kind of like a colonial country. It was very close to third world situation because so much of its population was poor and exploited. And I wanted to work politically. That was the time of Reyes Tijerina's land grant movement, which culminated in the armed raid on the Tierra Maria courthouse, which is quite famous. The last, or one of the only, I think, insurrections, what we call local insurrections in the United States in the 20th century, armed insurrections. So I went to New Mexico to work politically with what was going on there. I had no idea that the rest of the nation, you know, that wasn't leaving New York City and retiring in upstate Vermont or going to the base of Mount Tamalpais in California was emigrating to New Mexico. That took me quite by surprise.
What kind of conflicts existed then between the hippies who had come to New Mexico, the Native Americans and the Chicanos who lived there, and the land developers who were getting started there?
Let's see, background on New Mexico. Like I mentioned, New Mexico is very poor. It's 46, at that time it was 49th out of 50 states in terms of poverty. It's a state where 5% of the state's population controls about 80% of the wealth. About 60% of the population is minority peoples. It's Chicano or Native American peoples. In what you're talking about, many freaks, hippies, long hairs came to northern New Mexico. These were people who wanted to flee often urban existence. They were a lot of people, you know, the cliches. They had trust funds. They were poor little rich kids. Most of them had college educations. Many of them had built up piles of money, let's say, I don't know, selling stocks on margin in New York City or Los Angeles. Some of them had PhDs but were really sick and tired of the competition in the big city atmosphere. So they voluntarily chose to move into one of the nation's poorest areas. And northern New Mexico is as poor as any other section of the country. The only thing that could compare is maybe Beaufort, South Carolina, or some counties in Mississippi, right? And these people came into the area choosing to be poor, and which immediately set up a kind of hostility between them and local citizens who were desperately, you know, just trying to get enough to eat and move up in the world. And
they saw it as play poverty?
Play poverty. It was play poverty, sure. You know, and most of the freaks came into the area and hung around for about a year or 6 months or 2 years and discovered that poverty is really ugly. It's no fun, you know?
How is what you're describing different from what you were doing when you came down from New York? Because you were educated, came from an educated background, your family had lived mm-hmm. comfortably.
Oh, sure, yeah. I'm a middle-class, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, mm-hmm. you know, white man, sure.
Did you get into the same kind of conflicts that you were describing, though? Do you think that you were doing play poverty?
Well, first of all, I wasn't into poverty or whatever. I mean, when I moved to New Mexico, I did not have much money, right? But I hadn't sold a book in 3 years, but I did not walk around you know, trying to live in a commune or anything like that. That never interested me at all. I was trying to sell books and earn a living, that kind of thing. I didn't manage to sell another book until, 1973, I guess. But no, what I was doing essentially was trying to work with people, organizers, different groups in New Mexico, mostly in social struggles, whether they were social struggles around land and water rights, you know, local people trying to protect their irrigation rights or stuff like that, or whether people were trying to protect their human rights. And so I devoted a lot of time to a whole bunch of different groups, the same as I'd done in New York City. I mean, when I was in New York, most of my time, I suppose, was involved in organizing against the Vietnam War. And to that effect, I worked with groups as diverse as the Moratorium, SANE. I remember working for a peace candidate in Brooklyn named Mel Dubin, who was the first of kind of the peace candidates who tried to run and lost. And I continued, you know, operating in that fashion. Most freaks or most hippies that came to the Taos area were totally disinterested in the social situation, the economic situation. They were simply absorbed in their own lives and their own shtick. Most of them also were totally ignorant, let's say, of Native American and Chicano culture and stepped all over it. You know, they had no desire to participate or become a part of the community on the terms of the community that they were entering. They simply walked in and said, you know, we're all peace, love, groovy people, and if you don't like it, you can all go bleep yourselves.
Did you become a mediator at all between those cultures?
When I first moved to Taos, I had, you know, I was real disposed to be friendly towards long hairs and that whole countercultural movement. After about 6 months, I became very turned off by it, and there really wasn't much mediating you could do except to encourage the freaks to leave. To get out of there, that they had no business. They were so disruptive, and they managed, you know, just their presence and their arrogance sabotaged an awful lot of social struggle in the valley, in the Taos Valley.
My guest is writer John Nichols, who's the author of The Milagro Beanfield War and a new novel called American Blood. John, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is novelist John Nichols. His 1974 novel, The Milagro Beanfield War, has just been made into a movie by Robert Redford. His new novel, American Blood, follows two soldiers home from the Vietnam War. Well, we were just talking about your early days in New Mexico, and one of the novels that you wrote based on the water rights struggle between the land developers and the Chicanos, The Milagro Beanfield War, has just been made into a movie. There's, briefly, is there a story that the novel and the book is based, the novel and the movie is based on?
There's a whole bunch of stories in the Taos Valley in northern New Mexico. Yeah. In particular, I spent about 8 years working with a group called the Tres Rios Association in Taos, which was a group of small farmers and irrigators on the ditch systems in the valley, struggling against the imposition of a conservancy district on the Taos Valley and the building of a major dam and recreation irrigation lake as a result of that. And the small farmers of Taos fought it for about 8 to 10 years and finally defeated it.
The script is, the movie was directed by Robert Redford. The way I understand it, the rights to your novel were optioned years ago, and the option kept getting renewed, but the movie wasn't getting made. What happened?
It took 14 years to make the film. Basically, it's real difficult to make any film. In this particular instance, it was real difficult to get the film off the ground, partially because the film features a lot of Chicanos as heroes. They basically derail or overthrow some major tenets of our economic system, which, you know, progress is our most important product, and a lot of people fight against that and eventually manage to defeat it. Hollywood has long been a pretty reactionary industry. You know, you could probably name on half the fingers of one hand the number of films you've seen featuring minorities, Hispanics, Latinos, or Chicanos, which treat them with dignity or intelligence. It just doesn't exist. for that reason, I mean, the major, one of the major problems in raising money for the film was that most people said, who wants to see a movie about a bunch of Mexicans? And another problem is probably the politics inherent in the novel. It's a very humorous book, and yet basically what it's talking about is class struggle. It's talking about people trying to avoid cultural genocide, and it's talking about a way of, the values of a way of life which are quite antithetical to the values of the way of life that's expostulated by the mainstream culture in this country.
There are times when, in order to make a movie good box office, the suggestion is to cast, you know, a big star in it. And I have heard stories where someone well, so a white person is supposed to be cast as either a Native American or
well, that's the history of movies up until almost the present.
Right.
In fact,
well, did they want to do that with your movie at all?
Sure, yeah. For years, the people who were trying to make the film, who held the option, their names are Bob Christensen and Rick Rosenberg, and they're best known probably for the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman. So they have a real social conscience. And they were trying to raise money, and when they came close to getting bread, it was usually contingent upon them casting a star in the picture. And the only star that would be acceptable to sort of money people for years was either Al Pacino or Robert De Niro or I think Charles Bronson, someone like that. In other words, not Chicano or Latino actors. And so that was another problem.
You had had experience doing rewrites of scripts. You had done that for Missing.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have people rewriting from your novel for the screenplay for this movie? Did you have final rewrite on it?
No. Basically, when a writer sells a book or puts it out on option, you lose most of your control over it. So I never had any final say or something like that legally. For all the period that the novel was out on film option, I always had a pretty close friendship or relationship with the people involved, so that I was always called in as a consultant to read scripts that were done. First three scripts done in the Milagro Beanfield War were done by other writers other than myself, and none of them were successful. But I critiqued all of them quite heavily, but not through any legal right to do it, simply because Christensen and Rosenberg were friends of mine and extended the courtesy, one, of letting me be involved in the process, and of, two, listening to what I had to say. All during the process of having scripts written on this book that were not my own, I felt that my most important role was basically to critique them from the point of view of trying to make sure that nothing patronizing or racist went through. You know, that was very important, because we live in a country where an awful lot of people are simply unaware of how they can be paternalistic or downright racist or patronizing or whatever.
Are you satisfied, and do you think the politics of your book have been watered down in the movie?
I don't know, because I haven't seen the movie. Mm-hmm. I think they've got a rough cut now, but I have not seen it. I've seen dailies and, you know, rushes of the film, and they're all, the few that I've seen were quite beautiful, or they were quite humorous, or they seem really right on. But you never know until a film is put together how it's going to turn out.
The movie we're talking about is The Milagro Beanfield Wars. And the movie is based on a novel of the same name by my guest, John Nichols, whose new novel is called American Blood. What keeps you in New Mexico? You went there in 1969. I don't know that you planned on staying that long.
I didn't plan on staying. You never know, you know, how long you're going to be anywhere. I stay there, I guess, because it's become a real home. I've got real strong roots there. As a novelist, I think it's fairly important to have roots into a place or into a culture, because you get to know it real intimately.
It's interesting to me that you picked a culture that wasn't your own to lay those roots down in, because, you know, it isn't all that unusual for an outsider to come into a place,
mm-hmm,
and see that place differently than people who've always lived there do, mm-hmm, and be able to write about it very perceptively because of that outsider's vision.
Yeah, perhaps. I don't, you know, I've never felt, you know, we live in a country that sort of trains all of us to see all kinds of distinctions in each other and in each other's cultures and stuff like that. I never bought that from a very early age, probably because I come from a family where my mother was French. I mean, you know, natural-born French. She died when I was 2 years old, but nevertheless, half my family comes from Europe. My great-grandfather and my mother were from Brittany, which is also a different culture from the French culture. So I have sort of real strong Breton roots, and then I have pretty strong French cultural roots. I grew up in a family where if you didn't speak at least three languages, it was real shameful, you know. So I speak French, Spanish, and English. My mother was also brought up in Spain. I mean, though they're from France, my grandmother married a French industrialist who moved to Barcelona. My grandmother's buried in Barcelona, that kind of thing. All my little cousins sort of, I mean, they've been brought up in Italy, Switzerland, Spain, France, that kind of thing. So from a real early age on, I pretty much have been a tricultural person. Never felt comfortable any part of my life living in monocultural areas or middle-class areas. I've never felt comfortable in an area that didn't have a range of classes, you know, from working class to bourgeois class, etc. Plus, you know, from a real early age on, I mentioned I was in athletics, and I played sports, which meant I played a lot of sports with black people and Spanish-speaking people, you know, Puerto Rican, Cuban, Dominican, or whatever. My heroes growing up, you know, half of them were like Jackie Robinson, Roy Kemp, half of them were black, half of them were white. I was a big hockey fan because I played hockey, so half of them were French-Canadian, that kind of thing. I was raised, I became a musician at a really early age. My dad sings all kinds of folk songs in French, Russian, Spanish, etc. So, and I don't know, I got into blues guitar real early, which put me into another culture.
Right. We only have a couple of minutes left, and I want to bring the subject back around to your new novel, American Blood, which is about the violence during the war in Vietnam and violence in America.
It's mostly about violence in America.
I want to know if you've had to confront violence directly in your life, if you've been the victim of it or have friends who have, if you've had personal confrontations with it.
Every day. I've been in New York now for 3 days. I don't know, each time I've called home, my wife likes to jog. She's a good-looking woman. She puts on sweat clothes. She cannot jog 3 miles down a public road without having cars stop and people, you know, shout insults at her, make propositions, you know, put obscenities out. Yesterday I called her and she was in the laundromat and six sort of punk rockers came in and started doing the same thing, practically accosting her in the laundromat. I don't know a woman in this country. And I know I'm not alone, but acquaintances, wives, ex-wives or whatever, people that hasn't either been assaulted or actually raped.
So those kinds of personal confrontations,
they're daily in this
led
country.
To your interest in writing this book about violence.
Yeah. I mean, every time I pick up, I take personally what is going down to strangers in this country because it affects how I live at every level.
John Nichols, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been writer John Nichols. He's the author of The Sterile Cuckoo and The Milagro Beanfield War, which has just been made into a movie. His new novel, American Blood, is the story of the violence two men take home after the war in Vietnam. It's published by Henry Holt. This is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll talk with Benjamin and Carol Weir. Benjamin Weir was held hostage in Lebanon by the Islamic Jihad. He and his wife Carol had worked as Presbyterian missionaries in Lebanon for 30 years. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Cynthia Payne explains how she went from madam to British folk hero. Her experiences running a London brothel are the basis of the new film Personal Services. Also, music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new compact disc recording of Verdi's opera Don Carlo. Just in time for Flag Day, language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg translates the Star-Spangled Banner and the Pledge of Allegiance into plain English, and we'll get the latest news from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Now the news. This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new compact disc of one of the first complete recordings of Verdi's opera Don Carlo. It's one of the composer's longest and most complicated operas, and for these reasons it was largely ignored during the first half of this century.
The advent of CDs has proven a boon not only to the sagging classical record industry, but to music critics. Now they have a good excuse to go back and reassess some of their favorite older performances. I was delighted, for example, to find a new digitally remastered CD of the wonderful old Angel recording of Verdi's Don Carlo, conducted by Carlo Maria Giulini with the Royal Opera House Orchestra in 1971. At that time, any new recording of Verdi's most ambitious opera would have been an event, but this one also offered an uncut performance of his final revision, and it had a more consistently distinguished and plausible group of performers than any earlier recording. This dark, melancholy epic of Verdi's middle period was first composed for the Paris Opera, in French, complete with ballet, but it wasn't a great hit. Verdi spent 20 years reworking and cutting it. Now it's finally recognized as one of his masterpieces, perhaps the greatest embodiment of grand opera. What's most remarkable about Don Carlo is its Shakespearean scope, the way it combines and reconciles so many diverse and conflicting elements, actual history and the supernatural, politics and religion, spectacular pageantry, and tragedy of the most intimate psychological and moral sort. Verdi's melodic and orchestral inspiration never failed him. Here's a bit of the exciting third act trio with Placido Domingo as Don Carlo and Shirley Verrett as the Princess Eboli. She's in love with him, but it's dark and he thinks she's the queen. Cheryl Milne sings the Marquis of Posa, who has higher things in mind for Carlo, namely the liberation of Flanders from the tyranny of King Philip, Carlo's father. That was part of the third act trio from Verdi's Don Carlo. The beginning of the next act is one of the most perfectly constructed dramatic scenes in all opera. It moves from King Philip's great aria about the collapse of his relationships with his young wife and his son, he suspects them of having an affair, through his tense political battle with the ancient Grand Inquisitor, the Inquisitor wins. Then there's a confrontation with his wife, a duet that builds to a splendidly impassioned yet elegant quartet. This is followed by another confrontation in which the Princess Eboli confesses to the queen that she has falsely betrayed her to the king. She also confesses to being the king's mistress. The scene finally ends with Eboli's great aria of self-recrimination, O Don Fatale. The fatal gift she refers to is her own beauty. Let's go back and hear some of the quartet, in which the king and queen, Eboli and Posa, each sings of his or her own isolation, remorse, and ambition. That was part of the great quartet from Verdi's Don Carlo, sung by Montserrat Caballé, Shirley Verrett, Cheryl Milnes, and Ruggero Raimondi. Probably no single aria on the recording hasn't at some point been done better by someone else, Maria Callas or Ezio Pinzo or Jussi Björling. But probably no recording of the complete opera will ever match this ensemble of wonderful voices in their vocal prime. They're all given room to breathe without any loss of intensity by Giulini, whose too few recordings of Italian operas include some of the best ever made.
Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviewed the Angel CD of Verdi's Don Carlo. Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He's a poet and teaches English and creative writing at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Cynthia Payne. Although unknown in this country, she's a folk hero in her native England, where she's been arrested twice for running a brothel catering to older men. Her life is the inspiration for a new British film called Personal Services. It stars Julie Walters as the Madam, and it's directed by Terry Jones of Monty Python fame. I asked Cynthia Payne how she got started as a madam.
It's a long story, you know. I was a waitress, you see, and a prostitute came in and wanted to use my flat. I had one room. She said to me, I'll give you £3 a night if I could use your place. And I was working as a waitress for £3 a week in those days. So you can, and £3 all day in tips. So you can imagine what a lot of money that was. I said, okay. And then a lot of problems arose. She had a baby and I got worried about money. I just put a deposit on a house and what have you. And I decided that if I was going to make any real money, I had to do the bloody job myself. And I found being the prostitute was so hard. The first week I started drinking a lot of gin. I'm not a drinker, but I had to drink to do it. And even then, the drink didn't make it any easier. But then in that 2 years, I started to go out on escort. And the men used to tell me their problems and what they wanted from prostitutes. How hard prostitutes were. All they wanted was the money. They never wanted to have a chat and a cup of tea afterwards and all this sort of thing. So then I decided that after that 2 years, I decided to give men something a little different, which I thought they wanted. So I opt out of being a prostitute myself and I arrange these sex parties. And that's the rest of the story is in the film.
Can I ask you to give a brief description of the service that you ran?
Well, mine was what you call a very homely brothel. You know, it was done in my own home. And I used to give parties every 2 months where there was about 30 men and about 17 girls. And there was a lot of dancing. I mean, it wasn't just sex, you know. I mean, we used to have afternoon garden parties, you know, and you'd think it was just an afternoon party. Some of the girls would arrive even with hats on. But, I mean, there was sex going on upstairs in the bedrooms. But, I mean, that only lasted for half an hour. And then after that, they'd come down, have a drink, have a coffee, and it would be just like a normal party. But for £25, a man would get all the drink he wanted, food, striptease exhibition, sometimes a lesbian exhibition, that's if the lesbians turned up, and a girl to go to bed with all-inclusive for £25. So you can imagine that was very cheap. That they used to call me the Freddie Laker of sex. and it was amazing, really. I still made a profit.
What was the average age of the men who...
Oh, well, I never dealt with the young. They had to be over 45. People ask me why.
Yeah, why did you end up servicing older men?
Well, I don't know. I'm not interested in the young. I don't think they need me, for one thing. I think it was a need in me. My mother died when I was 11, and so I used to see my father moping about and taking to drink and going into pubs. And because I realised when I got much older and went into this business that it was because he wasn't getting regular sexual relief. That's why he was going in the pub. He was sublimating it. So over the years, I always felt sorry for older men, especially men that had lost their wives.
Judging from the movie, a lot of the men who came to your place had unusual sexual fetishes.
Well, no, not really. The whole world is like that. The only difference is, of course, you don't see it like you see it in the movie. I mean, we all have our fantasies. I did deal in a few kinky things, but relatively very little. It was mostly straight sex because, let's face it, at a party you haven't got time. And there was always a queue on the stairs for bedrooms. So if you did a lot of this kinky stuff, it would take twice as long and the queue would even be longer on the stairs and I'd have more complaints. But the kinky people that I did have, I really did those out of curiosity. I really wanted to see, you know, what they were really like, because I was fascinated by the psychology of sex, why men wanted all these unusual things.
Let me ask you, in the movie, the character that's based on you seems to find sex rather unpleasant, and the thought of performing sex with someone, especially performing oral sex, seems to vaguely nauseate her, really. Mm. Did you find sex as unpleasant as the character in the movie did, based on...
Well, the character in the movie didn't go into my young life. If they did, they would understand more. You see, my mother dying at 11, I had to bring myself up, more or less, and I always craved for affection as a young child, which my father never gave me. Well, then at the age of 19, I had one baby, which in the 1950s, it was a terrible thing in 1950s. To keep this baby, I had to go to a mother and baby home, and life was pretty hard. And then a year later, I met a very, very attractive man. And a year later, I got in the family way. And so, unfortunately, That second one, I had to have adopted, which, you know, it was a terrible thing to do in those days. I mean, to have babies and have to give them away wasn't easy. But I couldn't keep the two of them, you see. And then after that, I really fell in love with a Jewish man. I'm very partial to Jewish men. And I was with him 7 years. And then in that 7 years, I had 3 backstreet abortions. Well, I mean, can you imagine in that 7 years... everything was to do with either babies, abortions. So, I mean, at the end of that, I thought to myself, oh, you know, forget this love business, you know. Let's concentrate on money, you know, because by then I'm getting very, very down. But, I mean, if I fell in love even tomorrow, you know, I mean, of course I would enjoy sex, but I just don't enjoy one-night stands. And, you know, to me it's all just a pure waste of time.
One of your big Christmas Eve parties was raided.
Yes.
And you were busted.
Yes.
You were acquitted, weren't you?
No, you're talking about the last raid, which we're going to go on to. I got a keep to the first raid in 1980, and I went to prison. But it all happened again last May, just when I thought it was all finished, at a party. And I won my case last May. No, last February. So really, it was marvellous publicity for the film. But of course, I lost a year of my life worrying about it because I could have gone to prison again and I wouldn't have been over here promoting my film.
You wouldn't, would you start a service like this again?
Oh, I'd love to. My main ambition now is to go back to England and try and get our stupid sex laws changed. They're 350 years of age.
Why do you want to change the sex laws?
Well, it's stupid. If I can't give a party, well, not only me, anybody in England. It was proved at my last trial in February. Anybody can give a party like mine, and legally, that is running a brothel if they catch more than 2 couples in a bedroom. And people like me have parties all over the country. And I mean, men want sex, don't they? I mean, I supplied it for them at a very reasonable, very, very cheap in my own home. Why can't I give a party in my own home without people going upstairs to bed, without me getting into trouble? Well, you know, I mean, people say to me, can't you give a party without sex? And I say, no, they're boring parties, you know. They're boring. Men want sex. Men want to see girls and girls want to meet the men. So
what are you doing now to make a living now that you can't run a brothel anymore?
Well, everything. I'm banking on the film, really, personal services. I'm hoping that a stage play might come off. I mean, of my last trial, which was in February, a stage play could come off the court case because the court case was very, very funny indeed. And my agent tells me there's lots of offers coming in. And, of course, who knows? I might be over here with your Dr. Ruth on a... Can you imagine me and Dr. Ruth having a chat on the television, me asking Ruth about all these kinks and she'd be... You know, I think it'd be very interesting, don't you? So I think there's lots of things in the offering.
Cynthia Payne, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Cynthia Payne's life as a British madam is the basis of the new film Personal Services. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you following today?
Well, we're following reports that the Justice Department is planning to make a move to put the entire National Teamsters Union in receivership. And we also have a piece from Bill Buesenberg in Britain on the eve of the British election about the men who would be prime minister and the woman who probably will be prime minister again, Margaret Thatcher.
NPR is buzzing about a major science story that you're going to break on the program today.
That is correct. Correct, Fresh Air friends. Listen to this. Enough. Those are cicadas who are now all over the east coast of the United States. We will slow down that tape to hear exactly what they're saying.
Well, I want to find out what that is. Thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This Sunday is Flag Day. It's the perfect occasion to try to figure out why the Pledge of Allegiance and the lyrics to our national anthem are so confusing. Our language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg, has these thoughts.
People have been complaining for years that the Star-Spangled Banner is impossible for the merely human among us to sing. What's interesting is that you never hear complaints about what should be an even more serious deficiency of the song, which is that nobody can understand what it says. By way of example, listen closely and be prepared to answer a listening comprehension question when I finish. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous night o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming? Now then, what is the object of the verb watch? That is, what exactly was it that Francis Scott Key was watching? The broad stripes and bright stars? The flag? Listen again. This time I'll try to simplify the wording and untangle some of the syntax. Oh, say, can you see by the light of dawn what we hailed so proudly at the gleam of twilight, whose stripes and stars were streaming gallantly through the night over the ramparts we watched? That's right. What Key and his companion were watching was not the flag, but the ramparts, the fortified embankments around Fort McHenry. Oh, they saw the flag all right, but that's not what the song says. Now, you can write the song out and check it at your leisure. The point is that if you're like most people, you've never really thought about any of this before. But then, why should you have? After all, we learned these words when we were about 7 or 8, and children of that age could scarcely understand them. Over and above the stilted syntax, how many kids know what a rampart is? For that matter, how often does an adult civilian have occasion to talk about ramparts in the normal course of daily life? But why have we picked on an anthem that's so obviously incomprehensible, and how come nobody seems to mind? It's not just that the Star-Spangled Banner is an embarrassingly bad poem, if you actually stop to think about it. The fact is that we generally prefer for our patriotic ditties and oaths to be obscure. I was struck by this a year or so ago when I was helping my French-born wife prepare for her citizenship test. Her immigration lawyer told her to prepare for 2 items that were absolutely sure to appear on the exam. She should be ready to define a pocket veto and to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. It was the second of these she had trouble with. Oh, she learned the words all right, but she recited it funny. She said, "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands." I explained to her that she'd got it all wrong. Real Americans say it as if it were 4 long words. "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands." Now, you couldn't do better than this if you deliberately set out to write an oath that children would find utterly incomprehensible. I suppose that most of us wondered idly about it when we were kids. What does this word pledge allegiance mean, and who's this guy Richard Stans? It's interesting that people should get so head up about whether the words under God should be in there or not, and yet be wholly indifferent to the fact that kids can't make heads or tails of the pledge in the first place. The fact is that our pledge and our national anthem are exactly as we want them to be. We don't really want people to ponder these words too deeply, no more than we want people to reflect too deeply about their love of country. As an Italian friend of mine once remarked, America is the only country whose citizens are patriotic without being nationalistic. And when you come to think about it, most of the really good anthems do seem to belong to countries with strong nationalistic traditions. God Save the Queen, La Marseillaise, Deutschland über alles, even Dixie, I suppose. Now, those are anthems with a sort of stirring words and rousing tunes that you can sing with nationalist fervor. For example, when you want to drown somebody else's anthem out. Well, but that sort of thing isn't really for us. What we want is a song we can mutter inattentively from the bleachers.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. Here's a preview of our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with Anne Rule. She's a former police officer who switched to crime writing 19 years ago. Her new book, Small Sacrifices, is about the case of an Oregon woman who shot her 3 children. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review an album by the group Pianosaurus. They play rock on toy instruments. and film critic Stephen Schiff will review The Untouchables, starring Robert De Niro as Al Capone and Kevin Costner as Elliot Ness. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Audrey Voblitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.